Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WVUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
And I'm Deborah Wong. Coming up, Russia makes a deal with Iraq to write off billions of dollars in debt in exchange for access to Iraqi oil fields.
Democratic presidential candidate Carol Moseley Braun explains why she's still running, despite her poor standing in the polls.
Why shouldn't someone who doesn't have gazillions of dollars hold themselves forward and say, I have a plan for America?
More than 5,000 workers are killed on the job every year in America, yet few employers ever face prosecution, even for the most extreme neglect. We'll talk to a reporter who's done an investigation of the problem.
These stories in the life and times of the great Irish poet William Butler Yeats, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The Commerce Department today released its final report on the nation's economic activity for the third quarter, and it matched the previous estimate on gross domestic product. Analyst Hugh Johnson at First Albany Corporation says overall the economy was strong.
The third quarter is pretty much etched in stone. 8.2% growth in GDP, very, very strong, very, very solid growth in the economy in the third quarter, driven largely by, of course, consumer spending.
The Commerce Department also says personal income rose in November by 0.5%, and that's the biggest gain since May. And personal spending was higher last month, rising 0.4%. Families of nearly all of the 2,976 people who died in the September 11th terror attacks have filed for compensation through a federal government program. NPR's Trina Williams reports.
Some 95% of the families of those who perished in the 9/11 attacks have applied to receive funds from the program. People injured in the attacks also are eligible for funds, and more than 3,600 of them made a claim. The fund's special master announced the figures just after the midnight deadline. Created by Congress, the fund is expected to cost about $3 billion. The average payment so far has been $1.8 million. The highest award of $7.9 million went to a badly injured survivor. All payments must be awarded by the middle of June next year. Those who refuse to file with the government program retain the right to go to court and sue U.S. companies and agencies for negligence. At least one family decided not to sue or apply for federal compensation, saying the insurance was adequate. Trina Williams, NPR News, Washington.
Former Illinois Governor George Ryan will be arraigned in U.S. District Court today in Chicago. Ryan faces racketeering, conspiracy, mail fraud, tax fraud, and other charges in connection with a federal corruption probe. From Chicago Public Radio, Jay Field reports.
Operation Safe Road began more than 5 years ago as an investigation into bribes paid for driver's licenses while Ryan was Illinois Secretary of State. The probe widened into a larger investigation into corruption in state government that has led to indictments of some of the former governor's closest political associates. Prosecutors charge Ryan with using his power as governor and secretary of state to enrich himself and his family, friends, and political operation. The 22-count indictment alleges the former governor took payoffs, gifts, and vacation in return for letting associates profit off of state contracts and leases. It also alleges Ryan family members shared $167,000 in free vacations and cash. The former governor will reportedly enter a plea of not guilty at this morning's arraignment. For NPR News, I'm Jay Field in Chicago.
Work has started to assess damage after yesterday's California Central Coast earthquake. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger will visit some areas today. The Dow Industrials are up 11 points at 10,349. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, consumer sentiment fell in December, according to a University of Michigan survey, but it improved in the second half of the month following capture of former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. The final consumer sentiment reading for December was 92.6. That compares with 93.7 in November, but it was up from the 89.6 early in the month. Economists believe the overall decline from November may be due to some loss of momentum in recovery of the job market. The Bush administration is proposing the first change in fuel economy standards since the requirements were created in the 1970s. From Detroit Public Radio, Quinn Kleinfelter has more.
The proposed standards are included in a report released by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Though specific requirements have yet to be determined, the new proposals appear to target large vehicles like SUVs, pickups, and minivans. The proposed changes would divide those vehicles into various size or weight classes, rather than having a single standard for all. Federal regulators admit the new classifications may not increase fuel economy for all SUVs, but the new standards would bring the largest sport utility vehicles into the regulatory system. Currently, those vehicles fall outside of fuel economy regulations because those rules were written before SUVs became so popular. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
The top executive at Italian food conglomerate Parmalat met today with prosecutors investigating a nearly $5 billion shortfall in the company's balance sheet. The meeting came hours before the Italian government was to present a bankruptcy protection plan for Parmalat. Prosecutors have dubbed the case Europe's Enron. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces Driveway Moments, a CD compilation of public radio stories so compelling they won't let you go, at npr.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
Iraq's largest creditor, Russia, has promised to forgive $4.5 billion in Iraqi debt. The move was prompted by the promise of lucrative Iraqi oil contracts, which don't fall under American jurisdiction. Joining us to discuss the deal and how it affects American-Russian relations is David Filipov, the Moscow correspondent for the Boston Globe. Welcome, David.
Hi.
David, tell us, first of all, a little bit about what Russia is saying it will do. Is this a done deal, first of all?
No, it's not a done deal. Russia has to negotiate any reduction of its debt through the Paris Club, which is a group of creditor nations to which Russia belongs. But it's offering to make the cut, which is a big deal for Iraq because Iraq has $120 billion worth of debts, and any reduction it can get is going to be good for any new government.
This is, as you say, good news for the Iraqis, but how lucrative is it for Russia?
Well, Russia needs its companies to have access to the new Iraq, especially its oil companies. Iraq's got the second largest oil reserves in the world. Russian companies were in there. They had contracts, and then those contracts were dissolved before the war, and now the Russian oil companies are concerned that they're not going to get back into Iraq because Russia opposed the war.
Former U.S. Secretary of State James Baker just returned from a European trip where he was talking about debt forgiveness. Is Russia's move related to this trip?
Well, Secretary Baker's trip to Russia was definitely with an eye towards getting Russia to make a move like this. Russia countered that, yes, it would like to forgive Iraq's debt if its companies will have access to these markets. So this is a response to Secretary Baker's proposal and tacking on Russia's own concern about its own company's interests, which is something that the Iraqis agreed to.
The U.S. had already made a big deal about countries that were not part of the coalition not being allowed to bid on contracts involved in reconstruction of Iraq. Is this not included?
That first $18.6 billion worth of contracts for reconstruction projects that will be administered through the Defense Department, Russian companies can't bid on those. That's a blow for Russia because, like France and Germany, they wanted to be involved in this. But in the long term, Russia is looking for access for its companies to longer-term projects, including development of oil reserves.
So does this show that there are other ways that countries can bypass the United States ban and simply make their own deals with the Iraqi authorities?
Well, the way Russia sees it, and I'm sure other countries like France and Germany too, down the road, the United States isn't going to be calling the shots in Iraq. Iraqis are. And so conversations like the one the Russians had yesterday with the Iraqis lays the foundation for a relationship down the road when the U.S. is out of Iraq and when Iraq is going to look around and see, well, with whom do we want to do business? Do we want to do business with the Russians? Well, what do you have to offer us? And yesterday the Russians were saying, if you do business with us, we'll offer you this.
Is the U.S. weighing in on this deal? Do they care?
Well, right now it would be impolitic for the U.S., having just asked the Russians to reduce their debt, to then come in and say, oh, yes, you can reduce your debt, but not in return for promises of access for your companies. I'm sure that the Americans would not want the Iraqis to sign a whole lot of deals with Russian oil companies right now. The U.S. has oil companies, too, after all. But the first thing, and the thing that the U.S. has already supported, is the Russian willingness to waive part of its debt. So right now, the White House and the administration is keying on that, which is the positive side. As for the competition for who will get oil contracts down the road, right now the U.S. isn't going to say anything about that. But you know that they're thinking, we'd like to have our companies in there instead.
David, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David Filipov is Moscow correspondent for the Boston Globe. He spoke to us from Moscow.
The old tradition of the Afghan Grand Council, or Loya Jirga, appears likely this week to take a major step toward a new Afghanistan by calling overwhelmingly for a democratic system of government centered on a strong presidency. Carlotta Gall of the New York Times has been following the Loya Jirga, which has been meeting for several days now. Welcome, Carlotta.
Hi.
Carlotta, thanks for joining us. And first, just briefly, how many Afghans have taken part in the Loya Jirga, and what exactly has it been trying to do?
Well, there are 500 delegates from all over the country. They had district and province-wide elections to select these delegates. The president also appointed 50. So they've all come to Kabul. They're now on their ninth day of discussion. And they're going through a draft constitution that's been drawn up by a commission and discussing every single article and revising it in some cases. And then they should have a final vote on a final draft at the end of this week, we hope.
So, Carlotta, the new constitution, likely to be approved at the end of this week, will create a American-style democracy, strong presidency, legislature. What will it look like?
Yes, well, it's definitely democratic, calling for a directly elected president. It is styled, when you first see it, on the American system. Many delegates have been won round to the idea that right now, at this stage, Afghanistan needs a strong central leadership from a president because a parliamentary system which is based on regional representation could, you know, fall into the hands of warlords and drug lords and therefore be very unfair. At the same time, it's an Islamic country and a very strongly conservative Muslim country, so it's going to probably be called the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, and have phrases stating that Islam is the central religion and that all laws will be in keeping or not contradict Islam.
Who's angry about the Constitution?
Well, there's a number of groups. There was a strong feeling at the beginning in some areas for a monarchy because they had a monarchy before, and that strangely has completely melted away. There are some Islamists who are actually anti any constitution. They see it as a Western-imposed idea. The Taliban, of course, who have a few representatives here, not officially, but it remains to be seen in the final plenary session whether they will make a comeback and show some strength. In the committees, they have been, in fact, fairly good at working together, and in some committees they've had some strength. In other committees, they've been defeated on some of their more radical requests.
Carlotta, just to finish up and briefly, as someone who lives there and has observed all this so closely, how extraordinary a development is this, a democratic Afghanistan? Did you expect this? Do you think it will work?
Well, absolutely. We did not expect it to be so smooth. There was a lot of fear that the Taliban would do some attacks, you know, even bomb attacks or car bombs, or at least prevent some of the delegates coming to Kabul. That so far hasn't happened, and it's been very smooth on the security front. There has been genuine democratic discussion in the committee meetings and in some of the speeches in the plenary session. So that also is a remarkable step for Afghanistan when you think of it's had not only 25 years of war, but a real fear and intimidation in many of the regimes that we've seen, the communist regime and the Taliban, of course. Just the sheer, gathering of 500 delegates and mostly speaking and debating calmly is very impressive.
Carlotta Gall of the New York Times joined us from Kabul, Afghanistan. Carlotta, thanks so much, as always.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Department of Homeland Security has started adding immigration violations to a national FBI crime database. Immigration groups have filed a lawsuit to try to block the move. They say it should take an act of Congress to allow state and local police to detain people in violation of immigration law. Now, Congress is scheduled to take up the issue next year, but Attorney General John Ashcroft says his department's legal counsel has already decided police have the authority to arrest people on immigration violations. Caught in the middle of all this are police, law enforcement officers. Joining us on the line is Bill Casey, a deputy superintendent with the Boston Police. And thanks for joining us, Deputy Superintendent.
Thank you, Bill.
Superintendent, you're the head of the panel that advises the FBI on its database systems. Can you just describe the database at issue, who has access to it, and how it has historically been used?
Most of the data that's in those systems are, provided by local and state law enforcement agencies. Historically, they contain information on wanted people, missing persons, stolen property. In the recent years, it's expanded to people that may pose a threat or a danger to the public, such as the violent gang and terrorist database that was established, I believe, in 95. Convicted persons that are under supervised release and convicted sexual offender files. And those two files were made operational in 1999.
But it's not included immigration violators. Why would that be, from your perspective, a big departure? And I believe from the perspective of most police, not such a good idea.
Well, I think the average law enforcement officer, especially in the state or local side of the equation, over the years they've been trained if you put somebody's name into the computer system, let's say you're at 2 o'clock in the morning, you stopped a motor vehicle and you have a mobile data computer in your cruiser, if you get a wanted person hit, there's a warrant backing up that name.
Mm-hmm.
So you're arresting people based on a criminal warrant. And we do that every day of the year. Putting people in the system that have civil deportation orders, in a lot of states around the country and in our state, our legal advisors have told us that we don't have a power of arrest or a right of arrest. So it's, what we're fearing is that the federal government may have individuals that they sincerely want us to arrest. We're asking them get a warrant on the person, then put them into the file like you've always done.
What are the concerns, Bill, among police about police having to have, as part of their responsibility, bringing in illegal aliens, which has always been left to, federal officials to do?
Well, the concerns are that local law enforcement have groups that we deal with every day and that we work with, and these working relationships are predicated upon a lot of trust. And if we were to enforce some of the immigration laws that we historically haven't, people aren't going to be talking to us.
Yeah. Now, the Justice Department would say, of course, what about the case of Hani Hanjour, one of the 9/11 hijackers? He was here on a student visa but never showed up for classes. He was stopped for a traffic violation 6 weeks before he piloted a plane into the Pentagon. Now, if he'd been in the database, he might have been stopped.
But again, that goes back to our original request. If the person did commit a criminal act by overstaying a visa or for failure to depart, the underlying crime of when you have a deportation order and you stay in the country, why not get a criminal warrant to that effect? And then officers, no matter where they are in the nation, if they did that car stop, they'll know there's a warrant on this individual and they have a right of arrest that's not going to be questioned.
Bill Casey is a deputy superintendent with the Boston Police Department. Mr. Casey, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bill.
Just ahead, she has little money and is at the bottom of or not even registering on most polls. But Democratic presidential candidate Carol Moseley Braun insists she's still in it to win.
And later in the show, what happens when a worker dies because of an employer's neglect? Not much, a New York Times investigation found.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's here and now.
She was the first African-American woman to be elected to the U.S. Senate. She famously took on Jesse Helms in a battle over the Confederate flag and won. But among the Democratic presidential candidates, Carol Moseley Braun usually ranks at or near the bottom of most polls. The former Chicago politician, Illinois senator, and ambassador to New Zealand is undaunted in her campaign for the White House. She promises, if elected, to bring about an American renaissance with better public schools and universal health care. In our continuing series of interviews with the Democratic presidential candidates, Carol Moseley Braun joins us on the line from Chicago. Welcome, Ambassador Moseley Braun.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, it's a crowded field out there. I'm sure you'd agree that you are a long shot to win the nomination. What is it that prompted you to run?
Love of my country, the fact that this administration was taking the country in the wrong direction, and we have so many challenges to achieve peace and prosperity and progress in this country. I believe that my experience and my vision for America is one that would be good for the country, and I felt that it was appropriate with my, again, my background and my credentials to offer myself to the American people.
Well, let's talk a bit about what you do stand for. There seems to be a fight going on among the Democratic frontrunners to describe themselves as centrist. No one wants to be seen as representing the left or the liberal wing of the party. Is that how you would describe yourself?
No. I am a, if anything, kind of turn it around, I'm an old-fashioned, unabashed liberal on social issues and a conservative or moderate on fiscal issues. I don't believe that, I believe in balanced budgets. I was a co-sponsor of the balanced budget constitutional amendment. I don't believe in unfunded mandates. That was my first bill in the United States Senate, was against unfunded mandates. I believe in trade and free trade with, so long as we protect the environment and human rights and labor rights and don't allow for child labor and the kind of environmental pollutions that pollution that some industry allows. And so, you know, I don't know that if anything, that's kind of a different configuration, if you will, in terms of the where the traditional labels go. But I really genuinely believe that we have a responsibility to keep our privacy, to keep our freedom, to keep our individual liberty, and that, in my opinion, makes me a liberal, if you will, on the social side.
Well, many of your views don't seem substantially different from others in the PAC. You oppose the war in Iraq, for example, like Howard Dean. You support universal health care, like Dennis Kucinich. So what do you bring to the table that is substantially different?
In the first instance, I bring an entirely different set of perspectives and experiences to bear on policymaking, along with the capacity to do the job. We've never had a woman president, and I think it offers the American people great hope to be able to tap 100% of the talent in this country as opposed to just half of it. And I think that, frankly, that represents progress, expanding our democracy so that the voices of everybody have a chance to be heard among the halls of power and the leadership of this country.
But your rivals in the campaign have also raised women's issues extensively. They all eight men support abortion rights, for example. Is there something different in what you would bring to the table?
Well, but it's a matter, again, of perspective and what comes to your mind first before your pollsters get to you. I mean, the fact is I was the first of the candidates to raise the whole issue of violence against women and what is happening, frankly, at the Air Force Academy. I was the first of the candidates to raise the issue of the Patriot Act and what that meant, the whole issue of the pay gap and pay equity for women and pension equity for women. Not just for women's issues. Certainly women have been represented, if you will, from afar for centuries. I mean, that's been the case. But the question is whether or not, at some point, someone whose life experiences reflect the experiences of half the American population will be able to make some decisions. And as I've pointed out, you know, the guys have had a chance. We are witnessing in our time a situation in which we are threatened with being the first generation of Americans to leave the next generation less than we inherited from the last one. I'm not prepared to stand idly by and watch that happen. I think it's our obligation to do what we can do to see to it that the next generation enjoys as much freedom, as much privacy, as much liberty, as much opportunity, optimism, and hope as we had when our parents turned it over to us.
Now, you lost your Senate seat amidst some allegations of financial improprieties, and you were criticized for your close ties to the former military ruler of Nigeria. And it seems in this campaign that those issues continue to dog you.
Oh, I don't think so. I think, if anything, those issues have been dismissed and disproved entirely. And frankly, we've gotten, I think, a great leap forward in having put to rest a continuing set, the continuing babbling about something that was slander to begin with.
Some of your supporters, though, have been quoted in papers as saying that you're running to clear your name.
Well, those aren't supporters. Those are pundits, and you know that's what pundits do. I'm running to be elected, and I'm running to win. As I like to say, I'm in it to win it.
There is a new Washington Post poll today, and it shows you not even registering. How do you explain your low showing in the polls?
I don't, and I haven't seen that poll. There are polls and polls, but there are enough of them out there to keep me encouraged, and the responses I get from people in the field has been very encouraging. So we'll see when the voting starts. We'll see how it comes out.
How far are you prepared to take this? You've raised very little money relative to the other candidates, and your campaign staff is really skeletal at this point. Are you thinking at all about calling it quits at some point?
No, I'm not. And and the tone of your questions is all, why are you doing this and whatever? Why shouldn't I? Why shouldn't someone who doesn't have gazillions of dollars hold themselves forward and say, I have a plan for America? So, you know, my candidacy, my campaign is a lot less horse race than it is focused in on the substance of the interests and the concerns of the American people. And I am encouraged by it. The voting starts in about a month from now, and I will, we'll assess the campaign and this candidacy when that happens.
Ambassador, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, you're very welcome. Happy holidays.
Thank you. Kara Mosley Braun is a former Illinois senator and ambassador to New Zealand who is seeking the Democratic presidential nomination.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Spain passes a new law requiring that Roman Catholicism be taught in public schools.
And the Food Network's Alton Brown has pearls of wisdom for kitchen klutzes. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now.
Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, what happens when workers are killed on the job?
Employers who deliberately violate safety laws and kill workers face far lighter sanctions than those who deliberately violate financial or even environmental crimes.
And a new biography of the Irish poet William Butler Yeats.
His wife said one of the things that never ceased to amaze her was that he would always know how things would look to people afterwards. And his poetry has that magic of being timelessly relevant.
Those stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. A federal jury in Boston has sentenced admitted killer Gary Sampson to death in the carjacking and murder of two Massachusetts men. Audie Cornish reports from Boston.
12 Massachusetts jurors today decided that Gary Lee Sampson should get the death penalty for his confessed crime. Sampson pled guilty to federal carjacking charges against him for the deaths of 69-year-old Philip McCloskey of Taunton, Massachusetts, and 19-year-old Jonathan Rizzo of Kingston, Mass. Sampson's defense attorneys argued their client was mentally ill, a claim that was rejected by jurors who voted unanimously that his crimes met the legal standard for capital punishment. Sampson is also facing state charges in New Hampshire for the killing of Robert Eli Whitney. I'm Audie Cornish at the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston.
Meanwhile, a jury in Virginia is still deciding if Lee Malvo should be put to death. The 18-year-old was convicted last week of murder in connection with a string of sniper attacks last year in the Washington, D.C. area. Malvo's lawyers try to portray him as a young man desperate for a father figure. Prosecutors contend Malvo should pay the ultimate price for his actions. U.S. forces in Iraq are trying to stop Christmastime violence before it starts with a series of raids. Lourdes Navarro reports from Baghdad.
U.S. forces have arrested an ex-colonel accused of recruiting guerrillas and four suspected associates of fugitive former Vice President Izzat Ibrahim al-Douri, among a total of eight people. The raids that netted the suspects took place in Bakuba, 30 miles northwest of Baghdad. In comments made to the Associated Press, the head of the 1st Armored Division, which controls Baghdad, says additional security measures are being taken over Christmas due to a high security threat. Brigadier General Mark Hertling did not elaborate. Meanwhile, in Mosul, violence against Iraqis continues. Gunmen fatally shot a judge in his car there. The assailants escaped. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
A deadly house fire in Canton, Ohio, has left six people, including four children, dead. A seventh victim is being treated for severe burns. No word on what may have caused that early morning blaze. Aftershocks continue to shake Central California after yesterday's magnitude 6.5 earthquake. Two people were killed and dozens of others were injured in the quake. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is 7 points ahead at 10,345. The NASDAQ is up 11 points at 1966. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
Every year in America, more than 5,000 workers are killed on the job. In about 100 of those cases, investigators find that an employer's intentional wrongdoing or negligence or willful disregard for safety procedures caused the deaths. But in most of those cases, employers will never face prosecution. In a series of articles entitled When Workers Die, the New York Times found that OSHA, the federal agency charged with protecting worker safety, has repeatedly failed to seek prosecution for even the most egregious cases of employer neglect. Joining us on the line to talk about the series is the New York Times investigative reporter David Barstow. Welcome, David.
Glad to be here.
Let's start by talking about what we mean by intentional disregard for safety. Give us some examples of what kind of neglect that you're looking at.
What we're talking about here are the kinds of cases where an employer actually removes a safety device, like removes a guard from a piece of machinery because it will speed up production not to have that guard there, and then somebody gets killed. Or we're talking about a case where a company refuses to give a worker a piece of necessary safety equipment, say a harness if you're working up on a building someplace, or they refuse to give a worker training, safety training on, say, for example, being exposed to toxic gases in the workplace.
Now, you tell the story of one young plumber's apprentice, Patrick Walters, who died when a trench he was working in collapsed. And this was not just an unfortunate accident.
You're right. This was a case where Patrick's employer, in fact, had done practically the same thing about a decade earlier, where they had sent a worker into a trench without any of the safety precautions that you're supposed to take. And what's more, 2 weeks before Patrick Walters' death, an OSHA inspector came upon this very same company and discovered that, yet again, they were sending workers, including young Patrick Walters, into deep, deep trenches without the proper safety equipment. And then, of course, 2 weeks later, Patrick Walters was dead.
What happened to him?
He was actually, he was buried alive. He was working in a 10-foot deep trench, making a actually cutting a piece of pipe, and the walls of the trench collapsed in around him, and he was buried under thousands and thousands of pounds of wet mud and muck.
And this trench was not only not properly sloped, it was soaking wet after a rainstorm.
It was. It was, you know, trenches are extremely treacherous places in the American workplace. The rules are really pretty simple. You got to have the trench walls either sloped at a safe angle, or you have to have a trench box, or they've got to be shored up in some way. And you're supposed to have someone who knows something about trench safety actually inspect the trench before you let the workers go in and do whatever it is they're going to do in the trench. In this case, none of those things happened.
So this sounds like it should have been an open and shut case for OSHA. And you use this example to point out that, in fact, it wasn't. And there was no seeking of prosecution for this company. And it revealed a whole host of problems at the agency.
Well, we were telling the story, really, of the parents of this plumber's apprentice because, you know, they were sort of looking at this and thinking in a kind of a basic common sense way. Well, you know, of course, what's the big deal for OSHA to simply call up a prosecutor, a federal or state prosecutor, and say, hey, could you please look at this and see whether or not there's a potential criminal case to be brought? And instead, it ended up being this incredibly complicated sequence of events where ultimately OSHA decided not to seek prosecution against this woman, the owner of this plumbing company, not because of anything she did right, but actually because of something she did wrong. And the thing that she did wrong was she failed to have a competent person, someone who was schooled in safety procedures for trenches, inspect this trench before Patrick Walters got into it. And so from OSHA's standpoint, they said, well, because she hadn't had it inspected, she didn't maybe actually know that the trench itself was a danger. And therefore, maybe we can't actually prove that she had enough direct knowledge in order to justify a criminal prosecution.
Is this simply a question of a bureaucracy in the federal government not working, or is it a question of OSHA having a culture of reluctance, as you say, and simply not wanting to prosecute employers?
We think that we found that it was really the latter. I mean, there's actually the thing that's sort of amazing about it is when you talk to, I mean, you know, on an individual basis, you talk to OSHA compliance officers, the inspectors, you know, they get really disgusted when they see this kind of thing in the workplace. But what they tell you is these layer upon layer upon layer of kind of nitpicking internal reviews of these things just works to thwart even something as simple as, you know, hey, can we call a prosecutor and say, take a look? It's a really remarkable thing, the degree to which, on the one hand, they seem, compliance officers in OSHA would love to pursue these cases, and yet they just sort of feel that because of this bureaucracy above them that seems very timid and reluctant to draw any sort of attention on itself, and the sort of fear that they'll be seen as being too bullying to employers or too punitive to employers, that even something so simple as this somehow can't get done.
Another thing that you write about is that federal prosecutors don't want to pursue these cases because causing the death of a worker under federal rules is a misdemeanor. And you write that the sentence is 6 months, which is half of what you'll get for harassing a burro on federal lands.
Yeah, that's true. Now, there have been repeated efforts in Congress over a long period of time to make killing a worker a felony. Those efforts have all run into pretty heavy resistance from business groups. It's an interesting thing, and one of the sort of interesting findings in our series here was the extent to which employers who deliberately violate safety laws and kill workers face far lighter sanctions than those who deliberately violate financial or even environmental crimes. We were able to tally up over a 20-year period the total amount of OSHA fines imposed for employers who'd killed over 2,000 workers in this sort of most egregious way. The total amount was just over $100 million. Now, that kind of sounds like a lot, except you also have to remember that WorldCom, the telephone company that got in trouble for misleading investors, they recently paid a civil fine of $750 million.
In the case of this young worker, you talk about the effect of his death on his family. And his father is so frustrated with OSHA that he pledges to move to Washington to lobby against the agency until the day he dies, he says. And
yeah.
Is he likely to get any satisfaction?
It's unclear to me whether he will get satisfaction. So many of these families, you know, these deaths, they don't happen in bunches. They happen in, you know, spread over time, spread over geography, and you have families who don't really get that they might actually be part of a broader community of other victims' families. If those family groups were to sort of come together and form a constituency of their own, then perhaps their voices would be heard more loudly in Washington.
David, thank you very much.
Glad to be with you.
David Barstow is an investigative reporter. His three-part series, When Workers Die, appears in the New York Times.
Still to come, the life and work of William Butler Yeats in an acclaimed second volume from historian R.F. Foster.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's a wintry night outside, and you know, there's nothing like a nice log of coffee to warm you up. That's right, log. To explain, we're joined from Ottawa, Canada, by Rod Spruels, who's creator of something called the Java Log. Rod, welcome.
Hello.
Rod, what's a Java Log?
It's a fire log made with recycled coffee grinds.
I mean, did you just look at a big pile of coffee grounds one day and say, you know, I want to make fire logs out of them?
No, unfortunately, it was a combination of looking at coffee grinds and knowing that they're a waste product, and also knowing that they have more energy than wood, and also that coffee houses like Tim Hortons in Canada specifically were popping up everywhere, just like dandelions.
And pouring out all sorts of coffee grounds.
That's right.
You know, we're kind of making a little light of it, but it's really a great idea for recycling something that's all over the place anyway, right, in practically every home and in all those coffee shops. Now, these are on the market and quite popular already in Canada. I know you're biased, but they are very popular, aren't they?
It really did well in Canada, and actually finding it's doing well in the States, too. And we're just in the northeastern states, and unfortunately, we haven't started selling it online yet, but we're getting a lot of requests from people who don't have access to it.
So, how long do they burn?
About 2.5-3 hours.
I see. And environmentally, have they any advantages over other over ordinary logs or Duraflames? I mean, how are they environmentally?
We use a lot less wax than the typical sawdust wax-based logs. We're down at about 35%, where the others range between 55-65%, depending on who it is and what brand name it is.
I see. So it's not pure coffee?
No. We have wax in it.
I see. And you just compress it all into a log?
Yeah.
With a machine?
Simple process.
I see.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And the Java log is also superior because it produces less of what?
It produces less CO2, but one big reason, if you take one of our logs, it burns 2.5-3 hours, okay? And if you wanted a natural wood fire, an equivalent flame for the same amount of time, you would burn close to 20 pounds worth of wood, right? So there's a big advantage there. And again, back to the wax. Because we're using a lot less wax, there's a lot less carbon. And carbon dioxide is directly dependent on the amount of carbon in the fuel before you burn it.
So does the whole room smell like coffee when you're sitting in front of a Java log?
Absolutely not.
Not.
Some people want it, though. The reason being is that this type of product burns with very little smoke, and odor, aroma, is usually dependent on how much smoke is emitted.
Uh-huh.
So when you're burning a natural wood fire, you get a lot more of the smell of the natural wood fire. So, but if you do go up to the fireplace, not too close, I don't recommend getting too close or else all you'll smell is burnt hair, but you will smell coffee, but it's burnt coffee.
Rod Spruels, creator of the Java Log and CEO of Robustion Products Incorporated, joined us from Ottawa, Canada. Thanks a lot, Rod.
Thank you.
For more information on the Java Log, check out our website at here-now.org.
One more cup of coffee for me. One more cup of coffee for I go.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. In the life of the great Irish poet William Butler Yeats, there were times of such heated poetic inspiration that masterpieces poured out of him. He once wrote, "As if I were smoking cigarettes and lit them from each other." Genius almost unworldly. But Yeats was, all his life, very much of this world, too. He was a colossal figure, astride both the literary and political history of Ireland. Historian R.F. Foster took on Yeats' sprawling life 17 years ago when he began the first volume of his biography of the poet, which came out 6 years ago and was nearly universally acclaimed. Well, now R.F. Foster's completed volume 2 of W.B. Yeats' A Life, which is subtitled The Arch Poet, 1915 to 1939. R.F. Foster now joins me in the studio, and welcome, Roy.
Thank you.
It's so great to have you here. You've written the life of Yeats, this sprawling life, through the eyes of an historian. How does that change, do you think, the book that you wrote, as opposed to more of a literary scholar writing a history of this great poet?
There have been literary lives of Yeats. This is, I suppose, the first very comprehensive historical life. But I'd hastily say that I don't think you need a degree in English to be able to read poems or even to understand them.
Isn't that true?
I'm very convinced of that. And this is also an interpretive reading of Yeats's poetry. I mean, the poems I've tried to embed in the life as a historian would. I've shown how a poem emerges through drafts But I've also shown that it emerges from the circumstances of what he's reading, what he's thinking, what he's saying. And if I could make a risky generalization, I think literary lives are often content to stay with one great mother load of material. Historians are used to digging all over the field, looking at letters from people to other people who knew Yeats, looking at newspapers, looking at ancillary evidence, looking at legal documents, looking at investment portfolios even, why he authorizes different versions of his collected works. And then you realize that often any professional writer is impelled by financial obligations as well as the need to provide for a family, or in his case to rent a discreet apartment in London to see some new woman he's got very keen on. So there's those aspects of life as well.
Now, don't make him sound like he was a womanizer all his life, because one of the fascinations of Yeats from a personal perspective is, as the volume two begins, he's 50 years old. He's been over the years madly in love with a woman named Maud Gunn, an unrequited love for the most part. At 50, he's unmarried. He's never had a child. He's a very famous poet, but his life, in many ways, is just beginning, right?
Well, that's why I ended the first volume in 1915, just before these great upheavals. There's an Irish Revolution, the Easter Rising of 1916.
Ireland, of course, trying to be free of England.
It is the time when the Irish Revolution begins in a sporadic, peculiar way, with this sacrificial, hopeless rising and then a guerrilla war, which Yeats is secretly, well, privately ambivalent about, but actually throws himself eventually behind. Meanwhile, he is, yes, again pursuing his great love, but very rapidly starts pursuing her daughter instead, and then equally rapidly marries on the rebound a figure whom people hadn't known he was interested in at all, his wife, known as George Yeats. And there begins a whole new phase of his life. So in his early 50s, the world is made anew for him. He has children, he writes some of his greatest poetry, he wins the Nobel Prize, and he goes back to a now independent Ireland to play a part in Irish public life, and a very controversial part too.
Walking this difficult line between being a poet of visionary and mystical tendencies and also a very public man. He became an Irish senator in the upper house of the Irish Parliament.
And made many very controversial and powerful speeches. But he's a mystic who believes in the supernatural, who receives messages from the void through his wife's mediumistic interpretations and all this. But he's also an incredibly practical day-to-day operator. You know, he manages, for instance, when he goes to make a speech from the stage of his Abbey Theatre in defence of Sean O'Casey's
the great theatre on O'Connell Street in Dublin that he was the director.
He had founded. But when he has to make a speech from the stage defending the controversial work of Sean O'Casey, and he knows that his words won't be heard, he takes very good care to drop off the text of the speech at the night desk of the Irish Times newspaper on the way, so it appears in the paper the next morning. His practicality and his resourcefulness in everyday life is at least as striking as the extraordinary mysticism and visionary quality of his thought.
What drove this complicated man?
Partly a desire for power, which drives many people. And in his case, it's not only artistic power, which he achieves consummately. He is a very controlling and powerful personality who wants to place his stamp on the world around him, and he never stops trying to do that, disillusioned as he gets. One of the things that drives him is the desire to make Ireland a country that will be culturally proud, as he puts it once, and not vain. And his own work he sees as a centre part of that.
He dies in 1939, right before World War II was about to begin, or had even begun in some places. You've spent 17 years writing these two acclaimed biographies. Roy, you must have felt at times as if he was in the room with you. If he was in the room with us right now, or if one were to have met William Butler Yeats, who would they have met, and what kind of a man was he?
If he were in the room now, I think he'd be far funnier than he's generally allowed to be. I think he would be an endlessly fascinating conversationalist, as he was acclaimed, one of the great conversationalists of the age. But I think he would also keep a great deal of his secrets to himself. And in writing these two volumes, I've been astonished at the number of things that I've found that I had no idea of until I came across them. And I've also, I have to say, been very grateful to the fact that the Yates family have put no obstacle whatsoever in my way and very deliberately said they would impose no censorship whatsoever. Because some of Yates's late entanglements after his sexual rejuvenation operation and his fling with right-wing politics and his belief in eugenics, there's a lot of material there. It's of its time. Many people were misled in the 1930s, and Yates reserved to himself the right to be foolish always. And sometimes he's both foolish and passionate in a way that's very human.
A tumultuous and sometimes even silly life. And yet, I hope we're not giving short shrift in our conversation to what no biographer could ever really get to the bottom of, which was the genius. The poems are immortal.
The poems are immortal, and I think the work becomes more, not less, relevant with time. The mysteriousness of an apocalyptic poem like The Second Coming, which I mentioned, reads, as heaven knows these days, immediately to us, as it did to people in the aftermath of the First World War and the Russian Revolution. He has a way of catching history just as it happens. His wife said one of the things that never ceased to amaze her was that he would always know how things would look to people afterwards. And his poetry has that magic of being timelessly relevant, and in its simplicity and clarity often, as well as its strange oracular grandeur.
R.F. Foster is author of a new biography of William Butler Yeats. It's volume two of his two-volume biography of the great poet, subtitled The Arch Poet, 1915 to 1939. R.F. Foster, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And here's William Butler Yeats himself reading one of his most famous poems, The Lake Isle of Innisfree.
I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the vales of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore, while I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's grey, I hear it in the deep heart's core.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
And I'm Deborah Wong.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
Spain passes a new law requiring that Roman Catholicism be taught in the public schools.
And the Food Network's Alton Brown has pearls of wisdom for kitchen klutzes.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.